You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, in preparation for Monday's solar eclipse, we'll learn about why humans are so captivated by solar eclipses from an expert in both astronomy and anthropology. First, it's time for our weekly review of state news. On Tuesday, President Donald Trump said that both sides were to blame for violence at a white supremacist rally in Charlottesville, Virginia last weekend that left one woman dead. Here's a clip of the president from a Tuesday press conference saying that people on what he called the alt-left should share some of the blame.
You had a group on one side that was bad, and you had a group on the other side that was also very violent. And nobody wants to say that, but I'll say it right now. You had a group on the other side that came charging in without a permit, and they were very, very violent.
Robert Menser joins us now to look at how Wisconsin's lawmakers and others are reacting to that statement and to round up other top news from the past week. He's a senior statewide editor for the USA Today Network Wisconsin, based in Wausau. Rob, welcome back.
Hey, thank you. It is good to be back.
Well, what kind of reactions were we seeing here in Wisconsin from elected officials in the state to the events in Charlottesville and then to the president's reactions?
Sure. You know, Republican officials found themselves this week in a sort of a familiar position with a familiar dilemma, which is President Donald Trump says something offensive or incorrect or both, and then everybody looks to them to see how they're going to react. So this is you know, particularly following the Tuesday press conference that you played a clip of, you know, that's been really where the fulcrum is. So there's sort of a spectrum, right? On the one hand, those more supportive of Trump, Governor Scott Walker has avoided making any comment on whether Trump's statements were appropriate or anything to do with Trump's failure to condemn the white nationalist, the white supremacist groups in Charlottesville. Senator Ron Johnson said he was a little bit less, he was uncomfortable with the statements, but didn't really criticize the president directly and focused on that it's, you need to move the agenda forward and so on. So this kind of, you know, those people are more on the, you know, they've been more reluctant to criticize the president. More critical was Representative Mike Gallagher from Green Bay. His statement was a little bit more strongly worded. He said white nationalism and racism are antithetical to our fundamental values. The president needs to be crystal clear that hatred has no place in our society, but he is currently failing.
And then in the state legislature, Assembly Majority Leader, Republican Jim Steinecke, had somewhat stronger comments than some other state Republicans.
Steinecke was had a full condemnation. Some other state Republican leaders did as well. These guys are often, you know, they were sort of never Trump types during the primaries. Trump did not have a big base of support among the state legislators, and you know, they're also their state legislators. They don't ultimately have to vote for or against Trump's agenda in Congress. So in a way, they're just in a less of a precarious political position. It costs them nothing in a way to be critical of the president. But yeah, I mean, certainly Steinecke is one, and there are others who have on the state level who have spoken out against the president's statement.
And Paul Ryan, House Speaker from Janesville, in a familiar position, wanting to work with the president as House Speaker and trying to navigate how he responds to the president, to what the president said. What have we seen from Speaker Ryan?
Right. Paul Ryan is right. This is like his default setting at this point. He's been on this since the campaign. He wrote that white supremacy is repulsive. He was quite specific. There can be no moral ambiguity. What he did not write were the words president or Trump, and some people criticized him and called that in itself kind of politically slippery. But it was pretty clear what he's talking about. He didn't resort to any sort of both sides are guilty language. So,
and on the Democratic side, over the last couple of months, a couple of congressional Democrats have called for President Trump's impeachment. Now we see a response from U.S. Representative Gwen Moore from the Milwaukee area. What did she say?
Right. Gwen Moore, the Democrat from Milwaukee. Yeah, she, if there's a spectrum, she's all the way on the other end of the spectrum. She's a House Democrat. She was never close with Trump or any kind of ally with Trump. But there is something different when you go from being opposed to the Republican legislative agenda to actively calling for Trump to be impeached. The Democrats are not in power. She has no power right now to make that happen. But it is a sign of how intensely liberals reacted to these statements this week.
Any other reaction from Democrats?
I mean, I don't think that the comments went over really well, Rob. It seems like most of the reviews have been bad.
Talking to Rob Mentzer from USA Today Network, Wisconsin. He's based in Wausau. We're looking at some of the top stories in Wisconsin from the past week. Shifting gears, on Thursday, the University of Wisconsin Oshkosh Private Fundraising Foundation filed for bankruptcy in the wake of a scandal. This has been a story that's going on for a while now. Bring us up to date, Rob. What's been happening there?
Right. So the University of Wisconsin Oshkosh Foundation is a private fundraiser. Its job is to raise money that can be used for building projects or scholarships to support the university. And what is the cause of this sort of unfolding scandal is was a lawsuit that alleges that they moved money in the other direction. In other words, transferred $11 million in university funds from the university to the foundation instead of just using the foundation to support the university. What happened was between 2010 and 2014, the foundation took on some big multi-million dollar construction and renovation projects. And the lawsuit, which was filed, I forget, last month or a couple months ago, found is by the UW system as a whole, is alleging this this misconduct of using these university funds to prop up foundation activities.
Now, this isn't a scandal where anyone was profiting personally from it, as I understand it. Is that right?
Right. Yeah. That is important to understand. There have not been any criminal charges in this case, and the lawsuit the UW system filed does not make any such accusations that there's a former chancellor who's left, a former chief financial officer. There doesn't seem to be evidence that they were lining their own pockets. It's possible that there could be criminal charges in the future. We just don't know. But based on what has become public now, it appears that this was a little bit of an accounting maneuver meant to assist the foundation, so rather than self enrichment as such.
So why file bankruptcy, this UW Oshkosh Foundation?
Right. The bankruptcy filing will protect the university's endowment. Their case is that by filing for bankruptcy, they can restructure their debt and also selling off certain assets, but also protecting others. They claim that they have $15.8 million in debts and $14.8 million in assets, which is less. So they're going to have to sell. For instance, the official chancellor's residence under this filing would be sold. A university welcome center could be, this renovation project could be in trouble, may not be able to move forward. And there is looming over this the question of whether taxpayers could end up on the hook for this.
And finally, Rob, before we let you go, Monday, the big solar eclipse. We're talking more about that in just a few minutes. But are you making special eclipse plans?
So I'm going to take my kid. I've got a 6-year-old son. We're going to go to the Marathon County Public Library where I hesitate to say this on the air, but I'm told that they have glasses for the families, because that's the thing. You can't find glasses anywhere.
A hot commodity.
Yeah. But it's going to be cloudy. It's going to be cloudy in Wisconsin. We might. I'm getting worried that we're going to miss the eclipse.
Me too. But best of luck to everyone trying to catch the eclipse on Monday. Rob, thanks as always for joining us.
All right. Thank you.
That's Robert Mentzer, senior statewide editor for the USA Today Network, Wisconsin. He's based in Wausau and joins us every Friday to look back at some of the week's biggest state news. Most of North America will be able to see the solar eclipse on Monday. The path will travel from Salem, Oregon to Charleston, South Carolina. People outside the direct path will be able to see a partial solar eclipse, including us here in Wisconsin. Coming up, we'll find out if you'll be watching the solar eclipse and how you plan to do it. Now, humans have been captivated by solar eclipses since probably the first time a human saw the sun covered up by the moon. Anthony Avini is the author of the new book, In the Shadow of the Moon, The Science, Magic, and Mystery of Solar Eclipses. He's a professor of astronomy and anthropology at Colgate University. Tony, thanks a lot for joining us today.
It's good to be with you, Rob.
Well, you've seen...
praying to the eclipse gods for clear weather.
Definitely, definitely. Well, you've seen a bunch of eclipses, as I understand it, Tony. What is it about a solar eclipse that has always captivated us?
Well, it's the very sight of it, and words can't describe it. It's you're seeing something that is an interruption in nature. It's nature's interruption in the ordinary daylight period. And all of a sudden, it starts to get dark. The sun looks weird. It seems to be imitating what the moon does, going through a crescent phase. That's the way, at least, you'll see it in Wisconsin. And then if you're fortunate enough to be in that zone of totality, it's the stars come out. You're not used to seeing these things in the day any more than you're used to seeing a tornado or experiencing an earthquake. And even though we know what causes eclipses, it still is a phenomenon you're never going to forget once you witness it.
And it's the world going wrong in a certain way, and you can see why people throughout time have been fascinated. You have a quote from an ancient Greek poet saying, hey, don't be surprised in the future after seeing an eclipse if land beasts suddenly change places with dolphins and go live in the sea. This just says anything can happen if you're watching and don't know what's going on.
Well, if you know what's going on, you can recall the apocalypse when you see something like this. I mean, it starts for most people with a feeling of almost fear that changes to awe and then changes to bliss, and you go through all of that in 2 minutes if you see the darkness. The word sublime, I think, comes to mind. It's a term coined by Edmund Burke. Thomas Jefferson used it. James Fenimore Cooper used it to describe what they saw when they saw eclipses. Jefferson called the eclipse of the sun nature's most sublime affair.
And in your book, now you're an astronomer, you're also an anthropologist. So you look at the science, you also look at what we think about what's happening. And you, in your book, look at a lot of different cultures and how they've reacted. Talk about the ancient Mayans and how they used astronomy and thought about what the eclipse meant.
Well, what's interesting, you know, is that common sense for most of us is based on the idea that the material world, whether it be a rabbit's foot that you carry or the wood you think you're going to knock on or the eclipse you see in the sky, anything in the natural world or the material world doesn't have any connection to the human condition. But what we have to realize and what we learn when we study the anthropology of astronomy or cultural astronomy, which is what I work in, is that these eclipses had meaning to other people. And I kind of object to people saying that, oh, these were silly superstition, silly superstitions. The case in point, among the Maya, there was the belief that the moon was biting the sun. When you say what's that biting got to do with, the anthropologist learns that the biting is really not so much biting, but it's the moon whispering into the sun's ear, because the moon, who's the guardian of the night, is telling lies about people here on Earth and the evil things we do, and we just want to get his attention, and that's why we make all this noise when the eclipse occurs. So you look up at that sun and you can think, well, to the Maya guy, this is the sun's earlobe and the moon is whispering into it. Well, all that sounds very silly, but the whole purpose of the comment is to create a dialogue for the evil associated with lying. So it's really got to do with invoking a discussion about lying, and the idea of biting or talking into the ear or making noise is just it's the prompt for it, if you will.
Well, it seems like an amazing opportunity to take things we take for granted on Earth in our culture and reflect on them. That's what this symbolizes, probably not just for the Mayans.
Well, I think that's what brings us together, and it's what brings 80 million people together on Monday. But you have to see the total eclipse to realize what all of the impressions that impinge on your senses. I mean, you start out with the temperature dropping and your skin feeling cool, and then the animals begin to scurry around. And then, as I say, you look up the sky and you see the sun looking unlike it ever looked. And as the shadows sharpen, and you may see some sharper shadows up there in Wisconsin, it won't get terribly dark, but you can see reflected through the pinholes in between the leaves on trees, you know, as the wind vibrates the trees, you see these crescent images, thousands and thousands of them, rolling around on the ground in front of you. And what's going on? You know, there's so much of an assault on the senses that it's hard to take in. And then, of course, it's all over. And time goes backward. The moon then recedes from the sun, and the sun fattens up and goes back to normal, and everybody goes back to work. It's really something that we haven't experienced in this country for a long, long period of time. We'll see another one in 7 years, and you'll get a partial eclipse up there in Wisconsin as well. They both cross in southern Illinois, interestingly enough. So there are a lot of chasers, you know, like storm chasers, are headed for this place because they'll get to see two eclipses, two of these phenomena in 7 years. Jerusalem hasn't had one in 1100.
We're talking to Anthony Avini about eclipses and what we humans think about them. He's the author of the book In the Shadow of the Moon, The Science, Magic, and Mystery of Solar Eclipses. I want to step even beyond the eclipse, Anthony. You are kind of sad in a way. In modern culture, A, we're not as attached to nature as humans often have been. And even when we are, you write that we tend to look down at the ground and the stuff at eye level, and we've stopped paying attention to the sky.
Well, I think you got to blame that on Tom Edison. You know, back in 1882, near Christmas Day, he threw that switch down in Lower Manhattan on his DC generator and powered up the Great White Way. You know, that became the Broadway lights. I had a student in my class a couple of years ago, came from L.A., lived in the inner middle of the city, never saw the stars, and he couldn't believe what he saw looking up. He had to call his mother and tell her that he was looking at the sky and the stars at night. And they're always with us. It's interesting. It's half of the visual environment is what lies up above eye level. But we don't pay much attention to it because, you know, the lights and the buildings and lights of the cities and so on take that element away from us. So this will give us a chance to get back into the outdoors. I don't want you to watch it on TV. Go out, make sure you use the proper glasses, and just look up.
I think this, you know, when I go to a place without a lot of lights and I can see, you know, the band of the Milky Way out there and how awe-inspiring it is, especially comparing it to seeing the sky from a city. What do we lose when we don't have that connection with the sky?
Well, I think you lose that holistic view of what the natural world is. As I said at the outset, you know, we wouldn't think of the material world have any connection with us. But, of course, we know we live in an evolving cosmos. Carl Sagan wrote about that a long time ago. We may say that humans evolve, but the cosmos evolves as well. So we're connected to it. There's a cosmic connection. Since we're situated in lighted, artificially lighted, air-conditioned buildings, we don't bother to pay much attention to what's going outside. As I talk to you, I can look out my window and see a tree, and there's light on it. I'm not paying much attention to the birds in that tree or what's going on in the bark, and I'm not watching the shadow of the tree lengthen and so on. These are all things that live. There's a pulsating, breathing, living universe in the eyes of most people of the world. And we in the techno-west, of course, have had have nature replaced by the lights and that come from the techno-world.
We talked about the Mayan culture, some, and how they thought of the eclipse. What are some other historical examples, cultural examples of how people have read eclipses?
Well, eclipses are, you know, they were understood pretty well by the Babylonians. They really had a very good way of predicting them. They learned the 6-5 rhythm, the beat of the 6-month and 5-month period to come in between eclipses. But yet, when you look into other Babylonian inscriptions, even though they were scientists, mathematicians you could call them in a sense, they still believed that the heavens were a part of a domain that was controlled by deities who were their ancestors. They were related to these deities. And so having rituals conducted to making offerings of sacrifice, Really, we think of these as reciprocal reactions. We are paying back the gods. We kind of got to deal with them. We're paying them back for bringing us fruitful crops and so on. And the gods are revealing themselves when they appear as Venus and Mars and make their different motions and so on. It's a wonderful story, and I think we need to get away from taking the story too literally and maybe downgrading the ancients because they were superstitious.
Yeah, what do you hope we in Western civilization take away from these different stories from different cultures about what the eclipse means?
Well, I'll say cultural diversity, and I don't want to be too politically correct, but I'll say it is cultural diversity to realize that there are other cultures in the world who were quite capable of describing what they saw, of watching nature closely, even of making predictions the way we do. We're not so, I would like people to take away the image of us in the contemporary 21st century world maybe not being so different from them, and I think that's worth thinking about when we look up on Monday.
Well, my eclipse plans are going to be to step outside of work here and catch as much of it as I can in a few minutes. I imagine you've got a more elaborate plan, Tony.
Well, it's a pity you don't travel to the eclipse zone because I at the risk of making you feel bad, seeing totality as opposed to a partial eclipse is like being in the Super Bowl on the day of the game as opposed to the day after the game. My plans are to head down to Carolina, and I'm carefully watching the weather forecast because, you know, everything depends on it being clear. If it's cloudy, of course, you'll see it get dark. But if it's clear, you'll witness that sublime image of the corona and all of the other things that accompany the eclipse. So I'm going to hold my position somewhere farther to the north and then take the right direction, I hope, on eclipse day.
Well, I will miss the Super Bowl of the sky. Tony, good luck. I hope you find good weather to watch the total eclipse.
Well, enjoy the library. Take care.
That was Anthony Avini, author of In the Shadow of the Moon, The Science, Magic, and Mystery of Solar Eclipses. He's a professor of astronomy and anthropology at Colgate University. Coming up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio, but we are not done with the eclipse just yet. We want to know what you're planning on doing for the solar eclipse on Monday. Are you going to hit the road, head south, and try to catch the whole shebang, or are you going to watch it here in Wisconsin? Are you with a group? What are you going to do? Tell us how you're going to watch at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Tweet us at Central Time WPR or post on the Central Time Facebook page. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. We want to know what you're going to be doing this Monday when the moon totally eclipses the sun, or mostly from the perspective here in Wisconsin. Let us know if you'll be watching the eclipse, how you'll be doing it, and where. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Central Time Facebook page. A lot of people trying to get their hands on eclipse glasses so they can safely watch the event. Our producer, Halima Shah, talked to some people yesterday who were scrambling to get some of those glasses. She's in the studio with us now, not wearing those glasses. Halima, hi.
Hey, Rob.
Well, you went down to the UW Space Place where eclipse glasses are being sold. That's here in Madison. What happened?
Well, we got there at noon, which was the time the selling of the glasses was supposed to start, and they were all sold out. People had been lining up for a while, and they had all sold out in 15 minutes. I talked to some people who were pretty disappointed about it. I even spoke to the director of the UW Space Place, Jim Lattice, who kind of had to be the bearer of bad news for a lot of people. But here's one person, Adam Riggs, who went to get the glasses and unfortunately couldn't.
Well, I wanted to get glasses so that I could view the eclipse. And they're all sold out. I was surprised because they went on sale at noon and I got here at 12:09 and they were all gone. And I guess they're really in demand, I suppose. I think I saw on our neighborhood listserv that my neighbor might have some for sale, so I'm going to go ahead and try to like ping him with a message and see if I can get any from him, but hopefully we can get some by Monday.
It's a hot commodity, and you look to see if there is a market online.
There is definitely a market online. So I went through Craigslist, and just for reference, the UW Space Place was selling these glasses for $2 each. On Craigslist, people are selling these between $20 and $50. Oh. So more than like 100% price jump. And people are even posting about ride shares to get to St. Louis. Someone had posted about charging $85 to share their car to drive down to St. Louis, and that includes the cost of gas and insurance.
So if you've got no glasses, what are people's options at this point?
So you can actually DIY this, and there are options that are available. Actually, you can see it on the Central Time Facebook page. There are directions on how to make your own pinhole projector. You might have seen images from 1963 of kids with cardboard boxes on their head, and this is actually a tried and true method. There's a reason that image is still around. It does work. But I also spoke to, again, Jim Lattice, the director of the UW Space Place, and he also recommended pinhole projectors.
A pinhole viewer, a projection viewer, is a tried and true way of observing solar eclipses. And you put a pinhole in a piece of paper or aluminum foil or something like that, and that will act like a lens. And you can image the sun. You can image the sun then on another surface, like another piece of paper. And those work really, really well.
We are talking eclipses. Halima Shah, Central Time producer, is in here with us. And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. How are you going to watch the eclipse? Where are you going to watch the eclipse? Did you get glasses? Are you making a pinhole camera? Let's start with Victoria on the line in Madison. Victoria, hi.
Hi, how are you doing? Thanks for taking my call.
Sure. What are your plans?
Yeah, so I'm going to St. Louis with my three sisters. We're all going to stay in St. Louis, and probably the day of, we'll be watching the weather reports and the cloud maps and trying to find some clear sky to see the eclipse.
And are you staying overnight there?
Yep. So we're staying in St. Louis for a couple of nights.
Was it hard to get lodging?
I've been planning on this. We've actually been planning on this trip for a few months now, so we booked it way in advance.
And do you have glasses?
And it was already getting pretty crazy down there. So,
do you have glasses in hand?
Absolutely. And if we have some extras, we might have to post them on Craigslist.
All right, Victoria, thanks so much. Good luck with the weather. I hope you get a good look down there. When you were talking to people waiting for those glasses, I mean, were these people who are going to watch it partially here, or are they headed down to watch further south, Halima?
A lot of people are planning on heading down south, but I spoke to a lot of people, especially those with families who are like, you know, it's going to be hard to travel with my kids, so we're going to make this an event in our garden, and we're going to have a picnic, and we're going to see as much as we can from here in Wisconsin.
And you talked to some of the people who were hoping to get glasses about what a big deal this was for them.
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely been a big deal for people. This is the first time in 99 years that there's going to be a coast-to-coast solar eclipse in the U.S. And these people were not all big astronomy buffs. I mean, this is something that really everyone can enjoy. And it also seemed like, you know, we've been through a really tough election cycle, and this is kind of something that after this, like, relentless news cycle, this is something that's sort of bringing people together, and that everyone across the country, quite literally across the country, is going to be able to enjoy. And I spoke to one person, her name is Alice Schneiderman, and she talked about how important this was to her.
This is a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity for the family and for the kids, and I think it'll be a memorable moment, and we need those kind of things. This is what it's all about, you know. It's like spread the love, you know. There's so much negativity out there. Just here's a moment to thank goodness we're all here together, and we can unite as one humanity. It's one sun, one moon, one earth. So I'm excited. I think the glasses will make it even more special.
Is the eclipse a special event to you? Call in at 800-642-1234. Tell us how, when, and where you're going to watch the eclipse. Back to your calls now. Jennifer is with us in Delavan. Jennifer, hi.
Hi. I'm really excited about watching this because I live about 3 miles from Yerkes Observatory in Williams Bay, where that houses the world's largest refractory telescope. But they're having a nice little program there where they talk about the eclipse, and they provide the glasses for us to view, which I'm happy about because I ordered 5 pairs for my friends and I never got them.
Uh-oh.
So I'm kind of excited about being just at Yerkes Observatory and watching something like this happen.
And you said you're going with friends, a group?
Well, yeah, they have, I think they have probably over 50 people showing up, but I have a few friends that are going with, yep.
Well, Jennifer, enjoy the show. I hope you get a good look from the observatory. That's a good idea. And I know we heard Rob Mentzer, his local library in Wausau, is doing a thing. Observatories around the state are doing this. Again, from the people you talked to, Halima, who were sticking around, were they just going to do what I'm going to do and step outside their workplace, or are they making special plans?
There were a lot of people were in your camp. I think a lot of people are going to just step outside. It's still a Monday. It's a work day. Not everyone was able to get it off. But some people, you know, they're preparing for it. I spoke to one woman who said that she has been showing her son, who's 5 years old, videos of what a solar eclipse means. So even though they're not going to be able to go to a special facility to see it, he's definitely going to be able to value it.
Let's go back to our callers now. Larry is on the line in Wisconsin Dells. Larry, hi.
Hi. Yeah, we're on our way to Shoshone, Wyoming. Should be an area where the weather will be good. One of those places that the mountain ranges should prevent the clouds from forming. It'll be a drier area.
Wow.
On the east side of the mountains. But has anybody talked about using a strainer, a spaghetti strainer, or a colander instead of a pinhole camera?
Larry, before we get to that, are you driving out to Wyoming to do this?
Yeah. Well, we are right now.
You are literally on the road now.
Yes, we left from Michigan this morning about 7 o'clock, we're going to spend the night in La Crosse here in Wisconsin, and then onto the Shoshone area.
I love it. A great road trip, Larry. Happy travels, and good luck. I do hope you get clear skies there. I'd heard somebody ask about like a cheese grater or a colander. I'm going to go out on a limb and not recommend that, but I don't know. Is there something to that?
There is a video that NPR actually has up for 5 different ways you can watch the eclipse. The colander method is one of them, but there's some extra steps in there, so don't just go out with the colander. Yeah.
So NPR has a video on how to appropriately use a colander.
Mm-hmm. Yep, you can. There's a lot of DIY videos that are up there right now. I mean, for the most part, if you have at least a box and some foil and some duct tape, you are good to go. You may not even need the colander.
Okay, how are you going to do this? You're going to be here at work, right?
I'm going to be here at work. I'm going to be the person with the box on my head.
You're going to have the box on your head.
Yes,
we'll get pictures.
Yep. Absolutely. We can post them on the Central Time Facebook page. But I did recently move, so I have a lot of boxes, and I do own aluminum foil, too.
Okay. Maybe I'll be the one wearing the colander, as usual.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I'm hoping they'll let us go up on the roof here at Vilas. Who do we have to talk to? That'd be cool.
I don't know. Maybe we can just go.
Because we're up. That's 7 stories. That's up above the cloud level.
Oh.
Not really. That's not even vaguely true. Well, Halima, thank you so much for doing some extra research on this. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Rob.
That's Halima Shah, Central Time producer, co-host of WPR's pop culture pilot show Entertain Us. She updated us on Wisconsinites' ongoing search to find glasses to watch the solar eclipse on Monday. Keep sharing your story on how and where you're going to watch the eclipse. Tweet us at Central Time WPR or post on the Central Time Facebook page. Now, talks between the U.S., Canada, and Mexico kicked off this week as the three countries start the process of renegotiating the North American Free Trade Agreement, or NAFTA. It's been a rocky road for the trade pact over the past couple of decades, and it was a frequent target for then-candidate Donald Trump during the presidential campaign.
The worst trade deal ever made by any country, I think, in the world.
Earlier this year, it appeared Trump was ready to pull the United States out of NAFTA. He ultimately changed his mind, agreeing instead to renegotiate the terms of the deal. But with so many moving parts and complex issues, how do negotiators go about getting a better deal for their respective countries, and what would that look like? William Malden joins us now. He's a reporter for The Wall Street Journal, where, among other things, he covers U.S. trade policy. Will, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks so much, Rob.
Before we dig into this complex negotiation, can you give us a brief reminder, description of what NAFTA is and why it came under fire from Donald Trump and others?
Sure. Well, NAFTA is the big trade agreement one of the early major trade agreements that binds the U.S. to Canada and Mexico. And this was before the World Trade Organization, before many of the other trade deals that we've seen. And it essentially phased out tariffs for trade among the U.S., Canada, Mexico, got rid of those duties where companies could start to trade back and forth and make really efficient supply chains. But it's also, of course, you know, caused dislocations in certain industries. Auto parts production has moved south, among others. And we've, you know, it precipitated, or I guess it presaged a lot of other trade dislocations that came from China's rise as a major trading nation and from other Asian nations. So it's something that's very important to the U.S. economy and its development, but something that's also brought a lot of increasing political friction over the years. You know, we heard Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton criticizing NAFTA in 2008. Of course, Bill Clinton, when he was president, had helped pass the NAFTA through Congress in order to have the treaty take effect. And finally, when we got to, you know, the last election with Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump, it was anything but polite, as you know, sort of became a race to see who could criticize U.S. trade policy the most. Well, now, you know, Trump is the president, and he is following through with a goal of renegotiating NAFTA.
So as these negotiations kick off, what are we hearing from U.S. negotiators coming into the start of this process that could take quite a while?
Well, you know, Bob Lighthizer, who's Trump's U.S. trade representative, fired a pretty strong shot across the bow of the Canadian and Mexican counterparts on Wednesday when the talks kicked off. He said, you know, look, NAFTA hasn't worked. And that was a very different message from the Canadians and Mexicans. Now, you know, Mr. Lighthizer conceded that it has worked for some farmers, many of whom benefit from selling goods duty-free to Mexico. There no quotas or duties for pretty much everything headed south. But he did say it hurt a lot of workers and wanted to renegotiate it in ways that fundamentally changed the agreement, that increased the U.S. sovereignty over dispute resolution processes, basically give the U.S. freer rein on tariffs and other issues. He wants to change the rules of origin, the rules that determine which cars can be traded duty-free or other products, auto parts, and to do various things that the U.S. hopes, that the Trump administration hopes, will improve the trade deficit with Mexico, will improve the trade balance there. This was not really the Canadian or Mexican position. It's not the position of the U.S. business community or many Republicans in Congress, but, you know, the politics in Washington has changed. There's a lot of skepticism of trade agreements, and the Trump administration wants to do something a little bit different, if it can. That, of course, remains to be seen.
Now, President Trump, as we mentioned, seemed like he was maybe on the verge of just saying, nope, we're out of NAFTA. He walked that back. We're renegotiating now. But does that threat still loom over these renegotiations, that if the U.S. doesn't get what it wants, we could say bye?
That's exactly right, Rob, and I hope to do more asking the negotiators, because there's an army of negotiators working on every single detail of the agreement and how it could be changed or left the same or improved or even added to. But that warning that NAFTA could end, some have called it a North American Brexit, that the U.S. could exit NAFTA, is hanging over the talks. Some people don't take it seriously. There was a big congressional and business community backlash when Trump was considering pulling the U.S. out. But others say that, you know what, that's something that's a major risk for the talks. If Canada and Mexico don't agree to what the Trump administration wants to agree to, you know, those threats and warnings could come back. And we've even heard some groups on the left, you know, Public Citizen, for example, saying that if you don't see much improvement in the new NAFTA as opposed to the old NAFTA from their point of view, then, you know, it would make sense to have no NAFTA. So that's something you're seeing on both the left and the right. But the business community tends to like NAFTA overall. And their motto is do no harm. They don't want anything to mess up the supply chains. And they're worried that if things don't work out, that threat could become real.
That's a question I wanted to bring up, those supply chains, because now there are cases where a raw material might go to Mexico, get turned into an auto part. That part gets made into a car in a factory in the U.S. Or fuel might be refined. It goes from Mexico, gets refined on the Gulf, sold back to Mexico as some kind of finished product. What happens to that and many other supply chains if one country is just out of the deal?
Well, if one country is out of the deal, it would have a massive dislocating effect on supply chains. And, you know, I don't think it would be even hard to, you know, to comprehend what, you know, how that could affect the economy, especially industries like the auto, auto suppliers and auto industry, where, you know, they really do a lot of GM suppliers and other suppliers from the Detroit area went south of the border. And some of them make things all around the world. You know, the steel goes back and forth. It's finished, et cetera. So a pullout would be absolutely destructive to that and, you know, would require many, many years probably to overcome. But even changing the rules of the industry, for example, how much North American content has to be in a particular part for it to cross the border from Mexico to the U.S., that could have a major effect on the supply chains as well. On this day, that's Lighthouse, the U.S. Senator.
We're going to jump in. Line's breaking up there a little bit. William Malden is with us from the Wall Street Journal. We're talking about NAFTA and renegotiations, how they might affect trade in Canada, Mexico, and the United States, the timing, the politics, too, behind NAFTA renegotiations, whether the United States could just exit the deal altogether if these renegotiations don't work out. The renegotiation process started this week and could go on for months, maybe years, but there are some political issues behind the timing there as well. And William, I wanted to ask about the timing issue. These deals can take years to negotiate and renegotiate, but elections coming up next year in Mexico and the United States. How does that play into this?
Well, that's exactly right, Rob. The U.S. officials, Commerce Secretary Ross, for example, say that, you know, the Mexican elections could be a really important, you know, could be an important deadline, as well as the U.S. congressional elections. We've seen in 2016 how elections can change the tone on trade. And it's really hard to sit down at the negotiating table and work out a deal with three countries if you have a political opposition, perhaps a populist opposition as they have in Mexico, sort of undermining the talks or giving alternative viewpoints or saying that a country shouldn't participate. So they would love to do a deal by you know, January, before that Mexican election heats up, before U.S. midterm congressional elections heat up. But if they want literally the big overhaul that Ambassador Lighthizer set out and that the, you know, President Donald Trump says he wants, it's hard for many trade experts to see how you negotiate it that quick. It's never been done, frankly. The original NAFTA took years. The Trans-Pacific Partnership, you know, took 5 to 7 years, depending on when you count the negotiations. So they've set themselves up with a big challenge, but they're having negotiating rounds one after another. We finished this one on Sunday, and then another round could start in Mexico City as early as September 1st.
Now, here in Wisconsin, we're watching for dairy. There's been an issue with Canadian rules on the importation of particular kinds of dairy products. Big deal here in Wisconsin. And I imagine there's a lot of things around the country that look small to everyone else and are crucially important to that particular local or state economy. How much does that complicate this, that there are so many different stakeholders in all three countries?
There are so many. You know what? And Ambassador Lighthizer knows, the Trump administration knows, some issues are politically very important given congressional leadership. You know, Speaker Paul Ryan, of course, from Wisconsin, will not forget about the dairy issue with Canada, their supply management system for propping up dairy prices and protecting it from U.S. competition has ruffled some feathers before. He was big on that in the Trans-Pacific Partnership, the deal that never got ratified that Trump pulled the U.S. out of. So I think, with this dairy issue, they're going to talk about agriculture tomorrow at the talks, I believe, but Canada's probably going to have to make some concessions there, as they did in the Trans-Pacific Partnership. And if they want, if they want broad support in the House of Representatives, it wouldn't hurt for that key political issue. You know, softwood lumber is another issue. Senator Ron Wyden is the Democratic, the lead Democrat on the Senate Finance Committee that oversees trade, and there's a softwood lumber dispute with Canada as well.
And we're going to have to leave it there, the first of many conversations on this. Thanks to William Malden, Walt Malden from the Wall Street Journal, talking about the renegotiation of NAFTA.